Monster Professor.
Welcome to The Monster Professor, a show in which we discuss and explore monsters in literature, myth, film, games, folklore, culture, and beyond. I'm your host, Josh Woods, author, editor, professor, and monster expert. And today, I get to talk with a guest about vampires. And as for my guest today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Martin Lestraps. Now, he had me on his podcast. He hosts a podcast called the Martin Lestraps Show Podcast Hour, and you can just Google that or look it up on iTunes and find it quite quickly. Excellent podcast, and that's actually what gave me the bug to start podcasting, believe it or not. And so I get to talk with the man who got me in this direction. He's also an author. His debut novel, Inside the Outside, won the 2012 Paris Book Festival, the grand prize for that one. I saw him up for Indie Book Awards for his excellent short story collection, Dolph the Unicorn Killer and Other Stories, which has one of the best covers, by the way. The stories are great as well. I'm not diminishing those in any way, but you got to check out the cover of this thing, Amazon.com for those. And he's all in that collection of short stories. He wrote about some vampires. I really like those stories. And he also has a vampire trilogy of books. And The Vampire, The Hunter, and The Girl is the first one. And The Vampire, The Hunter, and The Witch. And then finally, The Vampire, The Hunter, and Frank. And he'll even get you started with a free Kindle edition on the first one to get you hooked on his vampire trilogy. Check those out on Amazon.com. I enjoyed our conversation. So without further ado, here is Josh Woods and Martin Lestraps talking about vampires. So first of all, thanks for coming on The Monster Professor.
It is not only is it my pleasure to be on The Monster Professor, I'm genuinely honored that you invited me to be on the show. Because when the show first came out and I was listening to the first couple of episodes, I genuinely was thinking to myself, this is really good, but it sounds like a solo podcast. So I don't imagine I'll ever have a chance to be on the show. So I'm actually very happy to be on the show because I didn't know that you were going to have guests at some point.
Yeah, I think I've enjoyed the guest episode. It's more than the solo episodes, I guess, because I don't know. It started off as a little bit like I'm just doing my lecture to myself in the microphone. But that's not. I'm not the only one who loves monsters. Everybody loves monsters, and so I need to talk to these people. So I'm glad you agreed.
And let me ask you a question, and I don't want to get off track because this is absolutely your podcast. But as a podcaster myself, I know from experience that the solo podcasts, while on the one hand they can be fun in their own right, they were a lot more challenging than I expected. So I'm curious as how it was on your end, doing just a solo, just by yourself in a room, filling up, you know, an hour or so.
Yeah, I haven't actually mentioned how hard it was on the podcast to get started, but it was like a traumatizing experience. I would sit down in front of the microphone, and I'd be like, okay, welcome to the podcast. No, that was horrible, and delete. And I do that for like 2 hours. And then I ask my wife can you like put in earplugs and be in the other room? I can't have the idea of someone listening to me talk to myself. It was too unnerving. And it took me a long time to finally get over all of that and just act like
it's
a normal
so
person.
It's so true. It's so true. Like, I feel like I had I was going to say stage fright. We'll call it podcast fright. I don't know.
Podcast
fright. Literally nobody was home. I was completely by myself, and yet there was something terrifying about pressing record and talking out loud. It was the strangest it was a completely new fear that I did not anticipate. And again, I'm sure like you, trying to talk yourself out of it, like it's just me in a room, just talk. What's the big deal? And yet, it really was kind of scary.
Yeah, I can lecture to a room of 50 people and, not sweat it a bit. And then the moment I'm by myself, like I'm terrified. I don't really know what's up with that. I'm over that now, but I've started a project. I've been keeping it a little bit secret, but there's no way to tell the story without mentioning it. So I'm turning my book, my novel, The Black Palace, into an audiobook, doing it myself.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I thought, oh, this is going to be a breeze. I'll just read my book. It is so hard. Like, it's 10 times harder than I thought it would be. It's harder than podcasting.
It really is. I've only ever tried, I've done a few audio versions of like short stories because I guess I was like, oh, this is short. This will be just a fun little quick thing I can do. And I agree. It's a lot more challenging. And I'll tell you what, because now I can feel myself unconsciously, drifting into podcast host mode. And that's very rude. So here's an offer I'd like to throw out to you. Because this is your podcast and I want to talk about vampires with you. If you're up for it, down the road, you and I'll just come back on my show and then I could ask you all the questions that have now just like queued up in my brain that I want to ask you about. And I don't want to be rude by asking them all on your podcast.
Well, I'd love to. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. As we mentioned, let's do one after this.
I'm happy. I am very happy to do that. Okay. So now we'll just a sharp cut right into vampires. My apologies, Josh Woods.
Well, how about I hit you with the question that everybody loves and absolutely despises at the same time. Who is your favorite? Who is your favorite, let's say, vampire who's a non-Dracula vampire? I talked about Dracula. I dedicated one episode to various versions of Dracula, and I even threw Nosferatu in there, so it might be unfair to, like, disqualify Nosferatu. But, but so, if you had to pick right now your favorite non-Dracula vampire, who would you go mm-hmm. with?
This is an excellent question. So let me see. So I'll start by saying, even though I've written, we'll call it literature. We'll put literature in quotes because I don't know. I have no idea if my work qualifies as literature.
Well, but, no vampire literature really started out as literature, though. It has to wait 100 years and then it's literature. Right.
That's fair too. So I won't be here for when mine becomes literature, but I like to feel like one day, it'll be after the zombie apocalypse, but then after we've rebuilt in their society and then they find the remnant, like digital remnants of stuff, and then they'll find, these stories, and then I like to believe they'll assume that I was much more famous than I actually was. I've written a lot of vampire stories, I've written a lot of pages. I've written my vampire trilogy, so it's a lot of pages, a couple vampire short stories that's in my latest collection. That said, I haven't read a lot of vampire literature, so excuse me. So my vampire references are generally going to be from television and movies. I know that doesn't disqualify anything, but I just wanted to, I wanted to be fair up front. That's where my frame of reference will come from.
Yeah,
so
movies, TV, that's fair game. Games as well, yeah.
See, this is why I like Josh Woods. I knew I liked Josh Woods, but the agreeable nature that I could admit something that I feel almost shame about, and then he just makes me feel better about it. Yeah, this is like therapy. I like this.
Vampire therapy.
Okay, so that said, I've spent the morning since I got up thinking about vampires and vampire references and thinking about just trying to go through my mind about sort of, when did vampires sort of infiltrate my imagination. I'll start by answering your question. So, my absolute favorite vampire universe is Buffy the Vampire Slayer. and of course, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, it's filled with vampires, but, the center of the show is actually, it's a vampire slayer. So in some ways, I almost relate more to the vampire slayers who confront vampires. But that said, if I'm looking at Buffy the Vampire Slayer and I'm looking at that universe, and then I figure if that's my favorite universe, it's only fair that I should pick a vampire out of that universe. So the main vampire for the first several seasons was Angel, and Angel was Buffy's love interest. So they had sort of a Romeo and Juliet, you know, she's a slayer, he's a vampire, can they make it work relationship. And after three seasons, he got his own show because he was a very popular character. I don't so David Boreanaz, who played Angel, I don't know him. I'm certain he's a very nice guy. I like to believe that. The character of Angel was my least favorite vampire on the show, so I always felt like I'm clearly supposed to like this guy, but I don't like him at all, very much at all. But then, but Spike, Spike, for anybody who's a vampire, a Buffy the Vampire Slayer fan, Spike is very well known, and he's, he's my favorite vampire. And if you ask me, an hour from now, maybe I come up with somebody different, but I absolutely adore Spike and every, and 'cause, and so Spike's, you know, his character arc on Buffy the Vampire Slayer was, you know, I mean, well, all the vampires on Buffy were evil except for Angel. The reason Angel wasn't evil is, he was cursed by a gypsy, and she gave him his soul back. So when he got his soul back, he basically had all the empathy and feelings of a human, but all the memories of being an evil vampire for thousands of years. So then he had to reconcile with all this evil stuff he'd done, but also he has to live forever, and he has a soul. And so beyond that, vampires in Buffy the Vampire Slayer are de facto evil. So Spike turns up as a, you know, as one of Buffy's one of her foes. And then, along the way through narrative conventions, I think just to, because they wanted him to be able to hang out with Buffy without trying to kill her. In season four, there was this underground, you know, military group, and they captured monsters, including vampires, and they put these chips in their brains where if they touched a human, they would just feel great pain. And so it was a way where, like, Spike could be around Buffy but not try to kill her, and they could develop sort of this love-hate relationship. But then, you know, but and so but it allowed him to sort of be, you know, not just be a vampire, but sort of develop as a character. Then along the way, he sort of develops a certain amount of, if not empathy, he's a certain kinship of, you know, the world's coming to an end, and I don't want the world to end either. So I guess maybe I could do my part to help Buffy keep the world from coming to an end. He's a much more interesting character. In the final, no spoilers, because I'm sure somebody's not seen Buffy yet, and one day they're going to watch it. The last episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, I mean, if nobody in that episode had a better exit than Spike. So, you know, that the longer I talk about this, the more validated I feel that Spike is my favorite non-Dracula fictional character. And there was actually, I don't know how much Buffy you've watched, but there was a great episode of Buffy that included Dracula. It was the episode one, season six, I believe. It's one of my, I loved it so much that I actually included it in my vampire trilogy.
Yeah, I even though Buffy the Vampire Slayer pretty much took over the 90s as I'm remembering it, I really didn't watch the show, and yet I know all the characters that you're mentioning, and I'm pretty sure I saw the Dracula episode, and so I guess I did watch it. I don't know. But weirdly enough, like, I feel like I'm one of the few people who kind of like lived through the 90s and didn't really get into Buffy the Vampire Slayer TV show, but the movie, when that first came out, I freaking loved that thing. Did you ever watch the movie the show was based on?
I know for sure that I saw the movie, and it's I keep wanting to say Jason Priestley, Luke Perry. I know Luke Perry's in it, right?
Yeah, well, I get the two, one of the two 902s.
So Luke Perry or Dylan, for anybody who doesn't care about real people names, but Dylan from 90210, the bad boy who had rich parents, but he had a trust fund, so he lived in an apartment, and he kind of went to school. The first couple episodes of 90210, he wore overalls with the one strap hanging down. And then they lost that very quickly. But if you watch the first couple episodes, that was Dylan's look. Along with sideburns, which I'm sure you remember in the 90s, thanks to 90210, sideburns. All I wanted was to grow sideburns, just to be like,
Bruno Mars is bringing all this back, I think.
He really is. So again, here's me accidentally derailing the vampire talk. So that said, I have seen the movie. I haven't seen it recently though. What's his name? David Arquette. I think he was in there as well. Christy Swanson played like Buffy.
But Paul Reubens was the henchman vampire. He's Pee Wee Herman, better Pee-wee known Herman. As, and he had the greatest death scene. It's like, I think it's just as simple. Like he was like the number one henchman to like the Rutger Hauer who played the main evil vampire, and mm-hmm. so I think she just like stabs him with a stake through the heart or something like that, and so he's like holding the stake like and he dies off in the background, and then they try to continue the scene, and then he rises back up still holding the stake going and he falls back down, and he's like they try to continue, and it's like a Monty Python moment in the middle of the movie.
That's funny. That sounds very familiar.
And Paul Reubens, who had not too long before he had been known only as Pee Wee Herman, then he got busted in that kind of like saucy, like shady mm-hmm. kind of, I don't know, like porn theater thing, and he had that famous mugshot. Well, when he signed on for that movie Buffy the Vampire Slayer, he had in his contract that he was allowed to look as much as like his mugshot as he wanted. And so he looks like the vampire version of his mugshot. That's hilarious.
That's great. That's the smart move. That's the smart move. Like really lean into that. That was before the internet. So you can, and you can only imagine how huge that story would have been. And it was still a really big deal.
Yeah.
Because if you were a kid, even if your parents didn't quite tell you what happened, you understood that Pee Wee Herman did something that you weren't supposed to know about.
Yeah.
You know what's cool about the movie is. So Joss Whedon, he was the screenwriter for the movie. He's also the creator and showrunner for the television show.
Yeah.
And so he wasn't a fan of the movie only because the movie it didn't reflect and as writers, I think we could both appreciate this. It didn't reflect the story and the vision and the tone he had in his head. Right. Certainly, you write a screenplay, a director gets it, becomes his thing, and then and that's kind of how it goes. But it sort of it was completely. I guess it felt completely different. And even the Kiefer Sutherland's uncle. What's his name?
His uncle.
He was in Buffy. He was Buffy's
Donald Sutherland. I thought
that sounds right. Yeah,
I thought that was his dad. Is that not his dad?
Look at this. Yeah, you can see how much confidence I said it with. So he might be his dad. I don't know. we'll do some real time research in a second, because we can't leave the listeners hanging, except for the ones who absolutely know and think that we're idiots. But. But I guess he was, I don't know if he was just like, just changing the dialogue or just not worried about doing it verbatim and just what, I guess little things like that. It just sort of soured him on the experience. And so he kind of felt like, as far as he knew, because it was the way things were, well, that's the end of Buffy. He wrote a script. He climbed the Mount Everest of selling that script, and then there was another Mount Everest of getting that script produced, and then only to have it sort of be a thing that you didn't envision. So he was disappointed, but what are you going to do at this point? He had a career. His dad, by the way, was a television writer, so he wrote on Captain Kangaroo and The Golden Girls, amongst other television shows. So there was that. Didn't love the movie, but whatever. It still got made, and that was a cool thing. And then a couple of years later, the WB was starting out as a network, and they needed content. And I don't know. I think it was because Warner Brothers produced Buffy. They still owned the script, and they basically owned the rights to the story. And this part I don't remember. I don't know if they approached him or if he approached them, because I think his wife basically encouraged him, like, why couldn't this be a TV show? Like, is there like any rule that says that like a movie couldn't also like be a TV show? Which of course, like now it's like not that big of a stretch at all. But at the time, it's like, you just make a thing and then it's isolated out there in the world. So he, went to the WB and they ended up making Buffy the Vampire Slayer. my mind what's great is it exists in continuity with the movie, so it's not a reboot at all. So in the movie, and you'll know this better than I do because you've seen the movie more than I have, in the movie, Buffy essentially blows up the high school, I'm sure, and you know, to help kill the vampires and stuff. So in the television show, she moves to a different city and she has to go to a new school because, you know, she blew up the high school gym at her old school. So she has to start a new school in Sunnydale. And so even though the show essentially is a reboot of sorts, it still exists in continuity with the movie. So they acknowledge the movie's narrative and move forward. So I always appreciated that about Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Huh, that's cool, and that absolutely made Joss Whedon's career. Like, that's what skyrocketed him, and now he can produce anything he wants.
Yeah, he did the first two Avengers movies.
Yeah,
what's he doing? He's just doing technically, I mean, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. He's the executive producer, creator on that. His brother and his sister-in-law, I think they're the main writers on that show. But he certainly used his Marvel pull to get that on the air, I'm sure, and it's a good show overall.
Yeah, for this kind of Buffy being your world for vampires, it kind of leads me to this question. Like, at one point, vampires are really terrifying to people.
Yeah,
like, I mean, you would be more afraid of the idea of a vampire than, say, the plague or a war, like this thing sneaking into your home and sucking out your blood and maybe your soul. And then somewhere along the line, in a relatively short amount of time, they went from scary to sexy. Like, everyone now just wants to date them. And Buffy the Vampire Slayer is absolutely deep in that tradition. Like, they're evil and you want to kill them, but you want to date them too. And like, so what happened?
That's a great question. And even with the Buffy vampires, they created, I'll call it a gimmick because I'm thinking in wrestling terms, but they created a gimmick where a vampire has a human face, but you know, when their fangs come out, their face becomes a little bit more monstrous, like the brow becomes pronounced.
Yeah, they do that, like cat brow makeup kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, so it changed, but then they also have the ability to be, you know, just handsome or beautiful humans at any given time, which sort of, you know, they found the line of where we can be scary vampires or we can be sexy vampires. I was thinking about this. I don't know that I could find a line in the sand, but I I'm thinking of like, well, actually, you know what? So my first, I think this is my first real reference to not just vampires, but Dracula was a 1979 comedy called Love at First Bite. Are you familiar with this?
Oh my God. Yeah. I think that's not, no, that's.
That's a George Hamilton playing Dracula.
I'm thinking of something different. I don't think I remember this thing.
Oh, maybe it's possible you're thinking of maybe the Jim Carrey movie.
I think that's it. Yeah,
but I can't think of what that one's called all of a sudden. But yeah, in fact, that's as I think about it, I call it a Jim Carrey movie. That was actually a few years before he became like Jim Carrey. He was he starred in the movie, but I don't think it was a big deal. I saw it all the time on basic cable, like Saturday afternoons on Showtime or whatever. It seemed to play a lot where he was a high school student who ended up being, I don't know if he became a vampire because of this sexy vampire woman.
Yeah, some chick that kind of just found him out there, and he's like this naive little kid. But that's not that one. You're thinking of it.
Yeah. So Love at First Bite, a 1979 horror comedy. And, you know, horror with a small H because it's really more comedy. But it was George Hamilton playing Dracula. So for most of my childhood, I mean, George Hamilton was Dracula. And Dracula, amongst other things, loved disco dancing because that was part of the movie. And Love at First Bite, as far as I can remember, I think it was, you know, loosely followed the vampire narrative, but it was placed in 1979 and there was disco and it was New York, but it was still sort of, you know, this vampire's come from Transylvania and, you know, I'm sure there was some version of the characters from Dracula. All of a sudden I can't think of anybody's names. I read the novel once and it was sort of, I read it because, you know, I felt like it was sort of, you know, it was, yeah, you know, it kind of felt like it was my duty to read it at least once, and I did. And both in the book, actually in the book, like, he's a vampire, but there's a lot less vampire than people would probably recognize. You see, he's more vampire, like in the movies and the television versions of himself. Yeah. But in Love and First Bite, and I think probably even the black and white movies from the 20s, Dracula was definitely a lot more romantic, a lot more sexy. He was very seductive. His monster. Supernatural powers were something of a metaphor for, you know, somebody's ability to seduce a woman sexually, even if it was against her better interest, that sort of thing. But from that, and it could be this is so my favorite versions of a vampire's. Of a vampires. That's correct English, right? Of a vampires.
Sure, it can be.
My favorite version of a vampire, possibly because of Love at First Bite, is I love the vampire who is dangerous and powerful and really could kind of do anything he or she wants, but doesn't, at least not right away. And they're actually sort of, you know, they can wear a bit of a human mask. They can at the very least, they can present something that looks like empathy and humanity, and they can be charming and you kind of like being around them. And, you know, and as an audience, you know that they could, and, you know, it just at a whim, they could take you out.
Yeah.
Which somehow heightens, you know, the charisma or something of that nature. So I like that vampire very much. And so that's the type of vampire that I generally write about if I'm telling a vampire story. But I'm also with you where, you know, I have very much enjoyed movies and television shows with the terrifying vampires where, you know, they're barely even, you know, humanoid character. I mean, you know, they have arms and legs and they kind of stand upright, but they're basically monsters. They don't even necessarily speak. They would more closely resemble a zombie in the walking, actually not the Walking Dead because they're slow, like a zombie in, well, what was the movie? I think it was
28 Days Later.
Yeah, 28 Days Later, where the zombies are, you know, super fast, which makes them ultra terrifying because the one benefit of a zombie is you can outrun them.
I think you kind of isolated maybe because it seems like a lot of the sexiest vampires have that thing where they're trying to be human and they're trying not to suck blood all the time and they're trying to connect to regular humans as much as possible, but they're always restrained. Like it's like a vampire coming up to you and like, look, I'm trying to be nice and I'm a really cool, sexy, mysterious person and I'm trying real hard not to just rip your throat out right now. And the girls are like, that's wonderful or something. And I guess guys too. I guess who knew that was such a desirable trait is to have your love interest constantly trying to not kill you.
But, I'm telling you, so something that my wife noticed about me, and I had no idea this was true about me, but, you know, whenever we would watch a TV show or a movie or whatever, I was seemingly very consistently always most attracted to just the meanest girls in the movies, including Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So Cordelia, she's sort of the as far as tropes go, sort of like the mean high school girl, and you know, like in a Buffy universe, given a choice, I pick Cordelia all the time, and eventually after several of these fictional characters that I was in love with, my wife was like, "What is it about these like mean girls?" And I was like, "It didn't even occur to me, but you're absolutely right." These are all awful humans, and I keep finding myself unwittingly attracted to them. Here's the other thing I love about Dracula to sort of go along with what you were just talking about. I love that Dracula. I love that he's not conflicted about about eventually, you know, drinking your blood, and you know, if you die or whatever, or you know, you die and you come back maybe as a vampire. He's not conflicted at all. He's just he's enjoying the process. This is all part of the art of seduction for Dracula. And there's no part of him that's conflicted. He just enjoys engaging with humans, and he's, you know, smart and articulate, and like I love all of that. And I also appreciate the vampire who is conflicted. So in my vampire trilogy, so book one is The Vampire, the Hunter, and the Girl, and it's heavily inspired by Buffy insofar as that, you know, I've got a human and a vampire who are attracted to each other, but then I also throw in a vampire hunter. So the vampire, it's actually a love triangle. So the vampire hunter and the vampire, they both love the same girl, and then the girl loves the hunter and the vampire. And then, you know, through the course of book one, they eventually become aware of each other and what they are, and they recognize the inherent tension of this love triangle. But, and this is a quasi spoiler, but not really, because if you read the prologue, it sort of sets it up anyway. The crux of the trilogy gets set up where, you know, right at the moment that the vampire hunter and the girl all realizes essentially who each of them are and how they relate to each other in real life, where the vampire and the hunter, you know, are supposed to kill each other, but they love this girl, and the girl, you know, loves them, and she doesn't want them to harm each other. And as I say it, it sounds much cornier than it is in the book, I think. But anyway, as they have this realization, the girl is mysteriously kidnapped, and then the vampire is kidnapped, and then the vampire hunter is kidnapped, and then they got hoods over their head. It's all very like mobster like, and then you know the hoods are removed, and they find themselves in this big mysterious room, and then there's these vampires. They don't know they're vampires yet, but there's like these vampires in tuxedos. They all look like very classy, butlers. And then there's a huge door, and through the door comes Dracula. And so Dracula is, you know, one of the characters in my trilogy. And so my Dracula, he's kidnapped the girl on purpose, and he tells the vampire and the vampire hunter, you know, there's this really evil, big, dangerous vampire in the world, the sort of vampire that Martin and Josh wonder why we don't see them anymore. He's out there in the world. But this vampire is so bad that he actually doesn't feed on humans. He feeds on other vampires. Not only is he bad, he's actually bad for vampire nature. And Dracula, he's sort of the king of the vampire world. He rules like a dictator of sorts. But the one that you like seeing on TV, and he'll make an appearance. Like there's no SNL cameos in the book, but he's the sort of vampire leader who would be on SNL, and you'd be happy to see him. and so he tells the vampire and the hunter basically, I'm gonna hold this girl hostage, and the two of you are gonna have to work together, even though you're natural enemies. You're gonna have to work together, and you're gonna have to hunt this big dangerous vampire, and you know, you have a week to do it. And if you successfully kill him, or at the very least die trying, then, you know, I'll let the girl go. But, if you don't even try, then I'll kill the girl. So now these two natural enemies, they love the same girl, so they have to work together. But then, of course, they ask the question, I mean, are we really like the best option to hunt this big, terrible vampire? And Dracula's like, oh no, absolutely not. Like, I asked like four other hunters before you. And then it's like, well, what happened? It's like, oh, they all died. Nobody's ever survived it. Confrontation with him, but if you don't do it, I'll kill the girl. And so then that sets up the rest of the trilogy. Of not only do they have to make this decision to save this girl that they love, they have to do so knowing that nobody's ever survived a confrontation with this big, terrible vampire. And I promise this was not me promoting my book, but so long as I'm talking about it, I will offer this one promotion. If you have a Kindle. Book one is actually free on Amazon in Kindle form. So you could read the whole first novel for free on Kindle. Actually, you know what? I think it's probably free most anywhere that you can get an ebook, which is, I'm so proud of the trilogy. It was sort of a way that I just want people, to read it. And just in case anybody's curious, and I'm sure Josh would know this, but the readers might not necessarily know that if the book's free, like it's not like there's any like secret money that comes on the back end. Like it's, it's free across the board. So if you download the book, you're doing me a kindness and there's no monetary benefit, but I appreciate it. And enough people get it that it's regularly like in the like top like 10, 15 free books of its category. So I'll stop with that and then just get back to Dracula because here's what I wanted to well, get to. It was that long-winded thing just to talk about my version of Dracula, which is he's a postmodern Dracula, and so he's completely aware of everything. Like he's read Bram Stoker's novel, which he liked, but he didn't appear in it nearly as much as he would hope to see himself in the book. He's seen all the movies. He likes the romantic black and white movies where he's like handsome and romantic. Wasn't a fan of the Francis Ford Coppola movie in 91 largely because he was a lot more grotesque, even though it was more loyal to the Bram Stoker book. And so the girl in the character in the book, you know, she's a big fan of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, so clearly an extension of me. And so she tells him, you know, like, well, did you know that you were also in Buffy the Vampire Slayer? And so then he's like, what? You're kidding me. And so apparently he's never seen this. So he wants to watch it. And she's like, well, you can't just watch the episode. It'll be way out of context. So all throughout book two, they go on a Buffy the Vampire Slayer marathon and they watch the entire series so they can get to the Dracula episode. And throughout, I find ways to tie in some of my favorite Buffy moments into the story itself and find some sort of poignant connection, so it's not just sort of a gratuitous, you know, Buffy talk. And so my Dracula, he's this all powerful, very omniscient. The longer you read the trilogy, part of the idea is he's very godlike. He's very sort of all powerful creator, knows everything. So really, he knows that he was in Buffy, but he also recognizes that, you know, this might be a nice way to connect with this girl that I've kidnapped. Like, oh, really? I didn't know that, but. He clearly knows he was totally in it. Anything he wants, you know, he can ask for whatever. He drinks blood out of a wine glass because he's classy that way. Whatever he asks for, you know, his butlers get it immediately. So there's nothing that he doesn't know. So intentionally, I made him very powerful, very godlike, very all knowing. He can, you know, at any time, and really in that way, he could also snuff out this dangerous vampire if he wanted to. But, you know, it's more interesting for him to sort of engage with humans and sort of, you know, there's no fun in sort of just snuffing anybody out. And so I like that version of Dracula and vampires, as well as whatever the conflicted ones. And I also recognize that I was being very long-winded right now. So you go ahead, Josh. I apologize.
Well, no, I was gonna, you brought up a few points that are kind of a segue to another thing I wanted to talk about, which was, in fact, you know, vampires in your work, because you were talking about this, the much more common vampire. I think we see the conflicted one who's trying mm-hmm. really hard not to be as much of a vampire as that. Like, I think Cassidy on Preacher might be an example of that or something. And this, in your book, one of your many award nomination finalist things, came from, Dolph the Unicorn Killer and Other Stories, uh-huh. which is awesome. And you've got you start off, I think, with a story called Vampire and the Madman, in which you got a very down to earth vampire just living in Vegas, working at a call center, like, you know, silver mining some slot machines for uh-huh. extra cash here and there. And this poor fella gets kidnapped and experimented on by these evil humans and he doesn't want to hurt anybody. And I think that I like him a lot, but something about that story and then elsewhere in your book, and you've got a lot of intertextual stuff, like you're talking about with, you know, having you can't have a Dracula character who doesn't, you can't have Dracula in your book who doesn't know Dracula in the world. You have to write a completely different universe. So I like that he's aware of his own media, and you do a lot of that. But one of these things that keep popping up that I don't know why it disturbs me, and maybe it's off track from vampires, but these underground tunnels in Las Vegas, like in that vampire story, you have these vampires going out and grabbing humans and chaining them up down in the tunnels. Mm-hmm. So you go down there and you feed on them. I think in one of your stories, there's this vampire-like woman who lures tourists down there and then feeds them to the city. And like it, like as soon as like this person gets lured down into the tunnels of Vegas, where all the like the druggies and the homeless people, they're all just like hanging down there like Morlocks. And you grab regular tourists and you feed them to the city. And then every time they do, like the lights are a little brighter and the drinks taste a little better. Like, I'm thinking, are there tunnels under Las Vegas? What is going on? So I don't know how much you're allowed to divulge if you know some like underground secrets, but what's up with the tunnels?
Here's the good news, Josh. And hopefully this will both brighten your heart and make it a little bit more difficult to sleep tonight. There are absolutely tunnels beneath Las Vegas. It is an absolute genuine thing.
Seriously?
And there absolutely are. And while there's not a ton of media coverage, you could dig around Google and you can find photographs and some videos. There's actually a book, and right off the top of my head, I can't think of the name of the book, but there's a journalist in Vegas who spend a great deal of time going into the tunnels and meeting the people who a lot of people just live there. In some cases, there could be some people who are just finding a place to maybe tuck away and do some drugs or whatever. That definitely exists. But for a lot of people, they actually live they live in the tunnels, and it could be it could be a combination of just a regular person who lost their job and then they lost their house and then they had no other option. In other cases, it could just be somebody who just for years they just couldn't quite fit into mainstream society, and so they'll have like beds and curtains, and they'll have a whole setup, and then there's because there's multiple people that will live down there. There's a certain level of community with at least some of them. And also because Vegas, like the weather in the summer and the winter, the weather gets very extreme. So in the summer it's extremely hot, in the winter it's extremely cold. And so summers in particular, because it's so hot, especially if you're homeless, then you almost literally have no manner of staying out of the sun. So then the tunnels became
really trying to get out of the sun like vampires too.
Isn't that something? As I said that out loud, I didn't
freaking
even
me out. Yeah. Like I've got my summer vacation plan now. I'm going to go to the tunnels underground Las Vegas. This is crazy.
And what's great, I mean, and great in the sense of that you and I clearly have similar sensibilities, is that they also do very much run like under the strip. So there is this, there's a physical dichotomy, this like living metaphor where you could be at Caesar's Palace, this over the top representation of wealth, and then literally right beneath you are people living in a tunnel because they have no better option. Wow. And whenever I drive around the city, because clearly, as you can imagine, there's not going to be like an enter sign that says tunnels enter here, but like I'm always hyper aware of like seeing something that like it's like that looks like an entrance. If I went into that, I think. And then there's always a part of me, I haven't done it yet, but there's always a part of me that's like very tempted just to pull over and then just sort of just kind of take my chances and kind of see what's what. So I learned that it's here's how and of course, when you discover something like that, especially as a writer, it's just ripe for fiction and storytelling. And so it's like, I have to use this somehow. This is just too fascinating not to use in a story. So in my vampire trilogy, So one of the things about vampire stories at all, whether you're writing one or you're just as an audience to one, I think something you always recognize is every vampire universe generally has its own vampire rules.
Yeah.
And there's traditional ones, and then, you know, I think every vampire writer, storyteller, everybody sort of takes their opportunity to add a couple of wrinkles, which in my mind, you know, totally fair game. Sometimes they're cool. Sometimes I hate them very much. So one that comes to mind, I actually saw it. So it was in, let's see, there's a good show called Being Human. There was a British show. They did an American version. It was the three characters. It was a vampire, a werewolf, and an invisible girl. I think she might have been a ghost. And this one, the vampire, he could go outside during the day as long as he wore sunscreen. And that, I hated that so much, because it was like, it's not that, not only is it not that easy, well, why have a vampire? You're clearly part of the fun of the vampire story is working within the boundaries and trying to figure out how to tell this story. The book, Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter, yeah, which I love, that's a great one. But in that one, I think it was a little bit of sunscreen, wear dark glasses and a hat with a large bill, and they could go outside. It's like, it's not, you can't, it's your story, you can do that, but I just feel like if you're making it that easy, then whatever. So like my vampire is absolutely the sun is just, it's a constant, it's, you know, in fact, in one of the stories, I think it's maybe the vampire and the madman, I describe it as knowing that for half of the day there's a serial killer waiting outside your door, and the second you step out, they're going to take you out. Yeah. Every day you have to live that way, and that's the way I think it should feel as a vampire. It's like, I'm immortal, but for half of my day there's a killer that absolutely I have no chance against, so I have to always be aware of this killer and I have to avoid it at all costs.
That makes everything more interesting when you play with these kind of boundaries. I think if Bram Stoker had, you know, continued on for decades afterward, he would have added that back, because, you know, Dracula, of course, in the original novel can go out in daytime and it doesn't bother him. But I think it was that Nosferatu film, the German film that started, the sunlight utterly destroys him. And that's a great addition. And I think that's one that should stay. Absolutely.
So. Yeah. So like there's that. And then, you know, like I like how vampires die, like, you know, there's traditional, well, you know, like garlic, I like that was, I like garlic as far as a vampire foe, cause it's sort of, It almost definitely has roots somewhere, and I've read different. I don't know if there's like one single source as to where the vampires and garlic thing came from. Part of it, I'm trying to think. Part of it, there was a time where I'm sure it was a combination of like body snatchers, grave robbers.
Yeah.
So, you know, so then people just would attribute this to like, oh, they came back to life and there's something like that. I think there's also a certain level of, you know, before medical science had advanced, people having the appearance of being dead, but really they were just sort of whatever in some deep coma state, and then they came back to life. And then, you know, there was some thought of, you know, whatever they were. They've come back from the dead and they're vampires or something like that. The garlic, nothing immediate. Like, I know I've certainly looked for it, and I don't think I ever found like one source for it. But nonetheless, like, I liked the idea of garlic hurting vampires. So I kept the garlic thing for sure. But like, garlic, it doesn't kill them, but it hurts to the touch very bad, and they can't. For all of their heightened senses, including a sense of smell, they can't smell garlic. So it's like just some cruel evolutionary joke that this thing that hurts them very much, they can't ever sense it. So it hurts them. Silver, on the other hand, outside of like fire and sunlight, silver is absolutely devastating, and it won't kill them to the touch, but silver can penetrate them in the same way that just, you know, steel can hurt a human. So in my book, if you're a vampire, you know, you can be like getting whatever, getting shot by a bullet, it's not going to tickle, but you know, it's not going to hurt you. Getting shot with a silver bullet, it'll hurt very much, and it has the same effect, because for my vampires, it's not that the silver, it's not like a poison specifically that kills them, but they react to it in the same way that we would react to a bullet. So like their flesh heals at the same rate as a human would with a silver bullet. So they can bleed out because they're not going to heal as quickly as if they get shot with a regular bullet. Yeah. It'll, you know, whatever. But fire, sunlight, beheadings, all that. I kept all of that stuff. And then, there's one wrinkle that I added in the vampire trilogy, and because you read the short story, The Vampire and the Madman, you actually got a hint of it. But I added this wrinkle, which is going to sound completely absurd, but steroids, anabolic steroids, they have the effect of if a vampire ingests steroids, that they temporarily become human, so that you can actually. They have all the mortality of a human for a brief period of time.
So does that work if they like drink Brock Lesnar's blood and they get like a big load of anabolic steroids? Do they?
Absolutely. So whenever Brock Lesnar is in between UFC tests, that's the thing. So if they feed on somebody and there's steroids in their system, and so in book one, you know, this happens, but. You know, nobody knows why this is happening, where this vampire just all of a sudden has become, you know, like mortal and weak and no longer dangerous. And then along the way, let me think. It actually really gets more into book two. They kind of start to figure it out. I don't even think I mentioned this. So the vampire and the madman. That exists in the universe of my trilogy, so those evil human characters, those are the protagonists in the trilogy. So they all exist and they're all protagonists, and you like them all very much. But in the short story, when it's flipped and you see them from the vampire's point of view, hopefully you hate them as much as you love them in the trilogy. So the madman in the trilogy, he's this like he's almost like this James Bond vampire hunter, where he's like got a lot of money. A lot of like gadgets, a lot of research. He has scientists that work for him. And so he does like capture vampire and does test on them. And so he figures out there's this weird steroid, anomaly. And honestly as absurd as it is that steroids would have any effect on a vampire, I essentially gave myself permission to use it because I decided it's basically as absurd as garlic, but nobody questions that anymore. So
yeah, no, I love this kind of thing. And I think anybody who's listening to this who has done some writing, you know, in the supernatural kind of world, we have this kind of love-hate relationship with this codification of these supernatural things. Like if I want to use vampires in my way, I don't want to have to be beholden to all your rules. But with that said, I want all my own rules. and so we really do like play out, and the story doesn't really work unless you know all your limits. And then once you do, you have so much to play with. It's not as like imprisoning as it might sound. Once you start limiting, like, you know, this rule and that rule, and they can't do this and they can do this, and this hurts them. Absolutely. Then that gives you a lot to play with. I think it was the old Warner Brothers artist writer Chuck Jones used to say, "You've got to have your disciplines," and I think by that he meant like your limitations in order for the game to work. Like Marvin the Martian was a great example for him. Like, you know, we've got a character who, you know, doesn't really have much of a face, and so now you've got to figure out how to make him kind of emote, even though it's just like two eyes on a bowling ball kind of thing. Or, you know, in Roadrunner, let's not have them talk. And so, and that's our limitation or our discipline. And so once you lay out these rules, it's so much fun to play around with in the story.
It really is. It really is. One of the things, and I know you can appreciate this as a writer, but one of the, when I was first just sort of just working out the story, kind of outlining it, just trying to really just get a hold of this vampire universe and these rules and trying to figure out how it worked, is one thing that I kept coming up against is okay, if vampires exist in my, so one of the things I wanted was, I wanted to create a world that's contemporary. It looks like the world that you live in right this second, yeah. Except there's vampires. And I kept coming up against this thing of like, if there's vampires and they're strong and they're fast and they hunger for human blood, what's to stop them from just killing humans just full board?
Yeah.
And so even that question is where I had to sort of figure out, okay, how is it that how can we live in a world that looks like our world right now, but we don't know vampires exist? There has to be a reason for that. And so then I worked backwards from there. It's like, okay, well, they don't kill humans all the time because they're not allowed to. There's some sort of vampire law that says they're not allowed to, but who enforces this law? And this is where, and so then I kind of came up with this idea of like, well, the vampire, Dracula is like the king of the vampires. So he's the one that sort of looks over things and enforces laws and stuff. But then I was like, he's also sort of like hidden. No one even really knows he exists. Even other vampires, all they know is that they're a vampire and there's this rule that exists. And so then really it's just sort of like, I created this idea of just almost like an urban legend, just like, if you hunt a human just completely on your own, do so at your own risk, because I knew a vampire who did that and nobody ever saw him again. And so then it's just like out of this fear of that you just don't do it, which I was also honestly, I was, when you read the trilogy, you can kind of see that I'm playing a little bit with like religion as well. So a big part of, in any faith is like, well, why should I follow this rule? It's like, well, if you don't, there's this terrible thing that will almost definitely happen. So just don't take your chin. Just follow the rule, and then you'll know you're good. So I was definitely playing with that a little bit.
Yeah.
But then I thought, okay, but they still need blood. So then I created, these vampire feeding posts where it's like, okay, there are designated vampires who are allowed to hunt, and they can only hunt for the purpose of getting inventory humans to bring to these feeding posts, and they chain them up. And then it also ended up working as like they become these social hubs. So it's like, because a vampire, they're very solitary. Yeah. But it's kind of like Cheers. They can go to a feeding post. And they can see their buddies. They can go into a room. They could drink a little bit, come back, and it's a nice place to like socialize and stuff. And so for me, that's kind of how I got around. Okay, they feed. They have an organized way to feed at these feeding posts. And so in my book, the main post that exists in the story, it's actually at it's in a barber shop that after hours they use this barber shop, primarily because it was a barber shop like right in the neighborhood that I lived in. So I liked the idea that what if after hours, this is actually a vampire feeding post, and the barber knows about it, but only because like they basically almost like mafia style strong armed him to saying like, here's what we're gonna do, and as long as you're cool, we won't fuck with you, basically. Oh, by the way, I just dropped an F-bomb. I'm sorry. I don't know if you do that on your podcast.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Say all the fucking cuss words you want. I don't know. I have the explicit on there. I haven't tended to cuss, and I've apologized for my lack of cussing. I feel a little bit disappointed in myself. But you're going to feel really weird when you go down into the tunnels of Las Vegas, the day you finally do, and you get down there, and there are like feeding posts, and there's like the Cheers music playing, and they're like, hey, Martin, we've read what you've been writing about.
And it'll be so exciting for a moment until I realize it's not gonna end well. So when I went into Las Vegas in the vampire story, and it exists in the same universe, it was like this sort of very easy thing of like, well, of course the tunnels would also house these feeding posts. Of course, that'd be the perfect place to do them because they're out of the sunlight. They're convenient. They're tucked away. No one's ever going to bother them or look for them. Even if they did, you're not going to survive. But still, like, they would just as soon. Oh, that was another thing. And one of the rules that I kind of gave myself in this universe is that if you're a vampire, you can't advertise that you're a vampire. You can't go around telling people you're a vampire. That's almost as bad as hunting a human on your own. And then also like vampire hunters, they're boogeymen. Like they hear about them. They've heard stories about vampire hunters that they might exist. Most of them have never seen one. If they have, chances are maybe they didn't survive it. So a lot of it was trying to figure out, just logistically, really, how can I have vampires in this world but still make it look like our world, but still have the danger and the tension of having vampires exist. And so then part of the reason part of the reason that Dracula is essentially punishing the vampire and the vampire hunter, on the one hand, the vampire hunter, he hunts vampires, so Dracula. Oh, here's the other thing. Minor spoiler, but whatever. By the time you read the book, you'll forget that I mentioned this. So when Dracula's talking to the vampire hunter, he's telling him, like, you don't actually think that I didn't know you were hunting vampires. Like, I totally knew, and I let you do it. Really, you're kind of doing a service, because at the rate that vampires, are created, the earth would really be overpopulated, kind of like flies. So you're kind of like a spider in this world where I don't like you, but, I tolerate you because you actually keep the population down and you kind of serve a purpose of, keeping it from being overrun by flies. But now, you're going to, at this point, you owe me a debt. So that's why you're going to do this for me. And with the vampire, he's like, you're not supposed to be talking to this girl at all. She's not supposed to know you exist as a vampire. So, I can't let you get away with that. So their punishment is they have to go after this vampire who almost definitely they won't survive. If they do, they're kind of doing Dracula a favor by killing him. If they don't, well, that was ultimately their punishment. Yeah. So anyway, again, as storytellers, it was a lot of fun to sort of have these boundaries and try to figure out how to tell a story within the boundaries without doing something lazy, like put on sunblock and go outside. Like, that's fucking lazy. let's really try to figure out how to tell a story with these traditional vampire boundaries. Yeah. And it was difficult, but a lot of fun.
And then the great thing about this is sitting down and thinking through, like, every little logistical detail about how this world works. Like, that's you're working. That's work when you're writing and stuff. And then maybe really you don't get paid for it as much as the regular work by the hour. But I mean, that's one of the that's one of the fun things. Like, I think it was in junior high in some sociology class. We were supposed to take the principles of sociology and design a new society. And I talked my group into making a vampire society where we were walking through every detail. And it was one of the many times I got in trouble in school for turning an assignment into a monster assignment. But I think this has been kind of a fun exploration of some cool different types of vampires, but also kind of like how to, if you're interested in kind of exploring the world of vampires on your own, how could you do so? Well, fiction wise, I think you gave him a really cool tour, like a tour of how to think through your vampire world. And then nonfiction wise, now you know to add steroids to your vampire hunting kit. I'm gonna do that. And then you know where to start looking, the tunnels under Las Vegas. So I've really appreciated this, man. This has been a fun conversation. Thank you so much for coming on the show and talking vampires with me.
It was absolutely my pleasure, Josh. Thank you so much for inviting me. For as much as I love vampires, I rarely have the opportunity just to dig in and have a conversation like this. So this was absolutely my pleasure. Anytime you want to do it again, I would love to come back on the show.
Fantastic. Thank you again.